Walk across the courtyard towards the library.
Welcome to the February issue of Dog-Eared Reads, a place where you can find out what's happening at the public library, learn about authors and books, and everything that has to do with reading. Hi, I'm Lori. I'm from the Public Library Association, and it's my pleasure to be the host this evening for tonight's show. This is the final broadcast of Dog-Eared Reads. KPLA is finding that it's very difficult for us to keep up with a production schedule. I want to thank everyone who is listening to your Dog-Eared Reads for the past 2 years. It's been Kodiak Public Library Association's pleasure to bring this show to you anywhere, anytime you're available to listen to it. A great big thanks goes to KMXT for allowing us to use their production studio and helping us with various aspects of producing a radio show once a month. A big thanks goes to Mike Wall, Pam, Willie, Kayla, and everybody else on staff. We truly appreciate the help and hope that KMXT will be on everybody's list for Pick, Click, Give this year, along with Kodiak Public Library Association. On tonight's show, we'll let you know what's happening this month at the public library. We'll also have some poetry you may not have heard before recorded by Tayton, and we'll have an interview replayed by Bonnie Sue Hitchcock, as well as some reviews from the Alaskana Room by Bob Ross. We'll also hear a review of Madonnas of Leningrad done by Kate Lowen. So I hope you enjoy tonight's show, and thank you for listening. The Ancestry Club meets Thursday, February 15th from 6:30 to 8:30 in the Multipurpose Room at the Kodiak Public Library. You can work on your family tree, learn about resources, and ask questions. Linda Kozak will share some more strategies. The library offers Heritage Quest online with funds from the Alaska State Library and the Alaska Library Network, and the in-library use edition of AncestryLibrary.com, which is funded through the Kodiak Public Library Association. This new Ancestry Club has had only about 2 meetings, so if you haven't had a chance to join them, please come on down to the library this Thursday, February 15th at 6:30 to 8 o'clock p.m. The Alaska State Library has made its selection for the 2017-18 Alaska Read Book. This year, it's Steam Laundry by Nicole Stellan O'Donnell. And the public library has multiple copies available for you to check out, and they're also available through the Alaska Digital Library. Bob Ross continues his Drawing for Shy People at 6 o'clock p.m. on Thursdays. Kodiak Public Library Association is having its annual meeting on Saturday, March 17th at 9:30 a.m. upstairs of Monk's Rock in their Sunshine Room. On the agenda will be a report from the board on what's happening, a report from the library director on events at the public library, as well as elections for our board. We have 2 board member openings. If you're interested in serving, please contact Kodiak Public Library Association at kpla.alaska@gmail.com or stop by our next meeting on March 6th at 5:30 p.m. in the library. The public is always welcome to join the KPLA meetings, and we're very happy to welcome anyone who'd like to join the board. Stop in and see us. That's March 6th at 5:30 p.m.
And welcome to the Poetry Corner on Dog-Eared Reads, where we share good poems, sometimes for the season, sometimes just because. The Purple Cow by Gillette Burgess. I never saw a purple cow. I never hope to see one. But I can tell you, anyhow, I'd rather see than be one. And for those of you who like to go out on the water, here's a poem by John Masefield called Sea Fever. I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely sea in the sky. And all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer her by. And the wheels kick and the wind's song and the white sails shaking. And a gray mist on the sea's face and a gray dawn breaking. I must go down to the seas again, for the call of the running tide is a wild call and a clear call that may not be denied. And all I ask is a windy day with the white clouds flying and the flung spray and the blown spume and the seagulls crying. I must go down to the seas again to the vagrant gypsy life, to the gull's way and the whale's way where the wind's like a whetted knife. And all I ask is a merry yarn from a laughing fellow rover and a quiet sleep and a sweet dream when the long trick's over.
Thank you, Tayton. Those were moving. We'll hear one more before the show is over tonight. Now I'd like to replay an interview with Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in our Beyond the Cover segment. KPLA has asked Bonnie Sue if she'd come to Kodiak later this summer, and we're hoping that she'll be able to. Here's that interview.
Today on Beyond the Cover, our author interview section of Dog-Eared Reads, I speak to Bonnie Sue Hitchcock to learn about her writing passions, her work, and a little bit about her life. Bonnie Sue Hitchcock was born and raised in Alaska. She worked many years fishing commercially with her family and as a reporter for Alaska public radio stations. She was the host and producer of Independent Native News, a daily newscast focusing on Alaska Natives, American Indians, and Canada's First Nations. Her first book, The Smell of Other People's Houses, was published in 2016. Welcome, Bonnie Sue.
Hi, Lori. Thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. You have written The Smell of Other People's Houses, a story about several young people's lives in Fairbanks and Southeast Alaska during the 1970s. Threaded throughout the book are metaphors relating to the relevance of the smells of places. Where did this idea come from, and why do you believe it's important?
Well, the idea actually literally came in a writing exercise that I did with a friend. And we used to get together and just throw out prompts and ideas to write about. And she said, let's write for 20 minutes about the smell of other people's houses. Just this kind of idea, right? This quirky idea. Mm-hmm. And so we did. And it, you know, that was, I think I maybe wrote 800 words or something. And then slowly from that, you know, it morphed. And I rewrote it to make it a short story. And then I kind of, the book started to take shape after that. And the metaphor of smells, it was supposed to do a number of different things. Hopefully it did them. But originally this was going to be a book of connected short stories, not just one long narrative. And so that was my idea. And so the original book was, you know, 20 different characters, 20 different stories that were all just barely linked together. And the idea was that you would just, it's the same, it was supposed to have the same feeling that you have when you walk into someone's house and you open the door for the first time and you get this smell. And I think that smell is one of our, I'm sure there's been some science done on this, but it's one of our strongest senses, and it evokes all of these things like memory or just, it's really, really powerful. And I think sometimes when we walk into someone's house, we don't even realize how quickly we're being informed about things. Whether they're correct or not, we get an impression from that smell. And so that's what the stories were supposed to do as short stories, just give you an impression of this, of people, and then kind of move on to the next one. So that's why I wanted to call the whole book The Smell of Other People's Houses. And then through the editorial process and everything, it changed to be the book it is now. But I still think that when you make a judgment or a snap judgment about something as simple as like what something smells like, it comes from your own personal experience of that smell, perhaps, and then you sort of think you know something about those people, and you could be right or you could be wrong. So anyway, that was, all of those things were in my mind as I was writing.
It's very powerful, and it's brought up several times throughout the book and interweaves it very well. I really enjoyed that. And since then, I've tried to notice more and more when I go in places, that smells like our local True Value hardware store, for example, or that smells like Joe's house or something. So you've hit it on the head, I think. This book is told from four characters' viewpoints and their interconnectedness with their families and their friends. It's an interesting format to tell the stories, and I was wondering, why did you use this literary technique, and how did it help or hinder you in the writing process? Did telling the story like this make it easier or harder to write?
Well, that is a great question to bounce off the last one, because it's sort of related, right? So originally I had those 20 characters, and then, you know, I worked with two different editors throughout this process. So one was in New York and one was in London. It was this really interesting experience, especially because I had been an editor for radio stories, as you know. So it was fun to sort of be on the other end as well. And I could kind of get inside their heads. And when the book changed from being a collection of short stories to a long narrative, obviously 20 main characters is too many. And so they said, you know, we'll let you do six. You can choose six of these characters. I realized as I tried to do that, it was really difficult. So I chose the four that had, I thought, the strongest voices. All of the secondary characters in the book used to have like their own chapter. So every character that is in the book, almost every character had their own chapter. And, you know, I think it was really similar to actually putting a radio story together. And I did love doing it this way because I think that you learn more about people when you're in another character's head. And I think it's more three-dimensional. It's more like real life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would never do a radio story that had just one source. You know, you always want to get as many sources as you can to inform the subject. And that's what I was doing with this story. But because it's so funny, like a lot of these decisions are not as intentional as they might seem. You know, you have your original story and then over 18 months of rewriting a book, different, you know, things get dropped and things get added. And so it's really hard sometimes to go back and remember exactly the intent of why that particular thing is there. Mm-hmm. But that is why there's four main characters and why the story is told that way. I hope that answered your question.
Oh, that's interesting. Very interesting. Did you set out to write a young adult novel, or do you feel it's going to be read by many age groups?
I absolutely did set out to write a young adult novel. It is something that I've wanted to do forever. And 20 years ago, maybe longer, maybe 25 years ago, I was a member of the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. And I wrote picture books. And I really loved that genre of books and writing. And it just seemed kind of impossible. And then I sort of had this other life with raising kids and commercial fishing and public radio. And so it was something I came back to later as mm-hmm. this thing that just wouldn't die in my head. So it was always intended to be a young adult. And then I actually went back and got an MFA in writing for children and young adults just to sort of give me some confidence. I didn't really have the confidence to think that it was a possibility. And that was really helpful. So I'm glad I did that.
Well, it's on the Battle of the Books list this year for high school. And so, and it's also being read by book groups, at least here in Kodiak. We've had a couple of book groups, adults read it in their book groups and receiving some.
Wow, thanks, Kodiak.
You're welcome. In the beginning of the book, the prologue is written from Ruth's viewpoint. Why did you decide to introduce the story from her point of view rather than one of the other characters?
That is a good question about, you know, it kind of segues from my, like, some of these things weren't so intentional. You know, those chapters all got flipped around a bazillion times in the editing process. And I think in the end, why it came out the way it did, partially because a really important theme of the book is statehood, when Alaska became a state in 1959, of course. And so I needed to set that up, and Ruth's character really did that. Like, she sort of perceives everything terrible in her life happening, like, is connected with Alaska becoming a state.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, that the prologue is right around the time of statehood, and then the book jumps to 1970s. That's pretty much it. It was a structural thing more mm-hmm. than anything else.
And that was informative to us, that statehood wasn't something that everybody wanted, that there was some argument about it, or that the Native people felt it wouldn't be good for them. Of course, this story takes place before the pipeline, before Anilka, and starts before statehood. But it's a point of view some people don't know about.
Right. And I know it wasn't the majority point of view. I mean, Alaska, it was, was voted in pretty significantly. But there are pockets of people that were opposed to statehood.
I bet there were.
So I chose to focus on that.
Tell us about your life in Alaska. Where did you grow up? Where did you fish? How much time are you able to spend at home these days?
That's a funny one, Lori. Yeah, so I was born in Fairbanks. My mom was born in Fairbanks, and my grandma was born right across the border. She came over when she was about 10, so it was pretty much been that. My grandma's 97. She's still living in her own home in Fairbanks. But when I was about 5, my dad took a job in Anchorage, and he was a manager for Westmark Hotels. And so we mm-hmm. moved to Anchorage, and that's where I went to school, grew up. But we spent all our summers in Fairbanks, so I still think of Fairbanks as really, like, my home. And then I went to Sheldon Jackson College in Sitka and ended up staying there and commercial fishing there. And got started in public radio in Sitka at Raven Radio.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Well, some of the stories that you tell are definitely stories of home, I think. In the book, the character of Dumpling is very interesting to me because she's not one of the four narrators of the story, but she's very important to the story. And she seems to drive the three of the four narratives that are told. She's a sympathetic listener. She's a person that's well-liked. She saved those red strips from a slip caught in a fence during a flood in Fairbanks, and she has a whole cigar box full of them. I figure it's good luck, she said. Quote, you know, a reminder of what love can do. Sometimes you just have to hold on to whatever you can. Does dumpling represent something metaphorical or someone you may have known or loved in your family?
She actually is pretty metaphorical, and I'm really impressed that you got all of that out of her character, because my original writing of the book, Dumpling, was even more significant in those 20 short stories. She again, didn't have her own story, but you knew her through everyone else's story, which is similar mm-hmm. to what happened in the end. But in the original book, she was that link between everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And she is the most important character in my mind because of that, because of how she informs everyone else and how she kind of is that connector. She's a connector person. And I'm hoping that maybe someday I can revisit my, you know, everything changed in the book as far as, you know, the plot and different things, which is great. I mean, I'm happy with everything about what happened with the book, but there's an untold story that I would like to go back to at some point. I can't reveal too much in case I get to go back to it. I mean, I don't know if it will ever happen, but it is a significant sort of dumpling story.
Yes, she's an interesting character. We asked in our book group what character was everyone's favorite, and she was about everybody's favorite character. They thought she...
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Thought that she really did bring that connectedness to everybody involved in the story. What was the writing process like? You said you wrote 20 different characters, different points of view. Did you commit yourself to writing every single day? Was it written over a long period of time? What was the writing process like?
Well, originally, like I said, I went back to do an MFA in writing for children and young adults. And the original draft was my thesis for graduating from that program. And so that was written pretty quickly. It was about 6 months. It was one semester, the last semester of my MFA. And then after I sold it to the publishers, the rewrite took 18 months, the actual, you know, reworking of it. And at the same time, you know, we had tried to live in the lower 48 for the first time in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And our house got flooded in the 2013 floods in Colorado. And that was 2 weeks after I had sold the manuscript. So I didn't really have a home for 18 months to write in. And, you know, just other things, you know, life actually still goes on, whether or not you're trying to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun. So I wrote a lot of I ended up, you know, just writing when I could and where I could. But for me, deadlines are so important. You know, I've written all my life, and I think if I had never had a deadline, nothing would have ever been finished.
So do you have that advice? What advice do you have for aspiring authors, people who want to write? To have deadlines?
Nobody ever wants my advice, boy.
Oh!
But, yeah, I guess I would just say never give up. You know, I was almost 50 when this book came out, and I have been writing all my life. As you know, it's just something I do that I love to do, and I think if publishing is the way you equate being a writer, it might be a little more difficult, but I would just say never, ever give up mm-hmm. on what you want for yourself.
What authors or books have provided great inspiration to you?
I love the classics. I love Virginia Woolf, and I love Tolstoy. I read Anna Karenina every mm-hmm. year at Christmas.
Ooh.
I reread it. And then I love contemporary books, too. I read a lot. I read lately a lot more adult fiction because it's harder to read YA when you're writing YA, I just think, for me.
Uh-huh.
And so I love Anne Patchett. I love Lauren Groff and Miley Malloy, who also writes middle grade. She's kind of this amazing. She can write everything, short stories, middle grade, adult fiction.
Uh-huh.
And then I read poetry every single day when I wake up just to hear language, hear beautiful words strung
yes.
together like Christmas lights. Yeah.
Oh, neat. That's a nice metaphor. On your Twitter feed, you describe yourself as a public radio reporter moonlighting as a YA writer. Do you feel yourself more of a reporter, or do you feel you've morphed into a novelist now?
Well, it's funny. When I put that on Twitter, I probably hadn't even had, the book wasn't even published yet. So I definitely wasn't seeing myself as a novelist. And I still feel a little bit amazed that I have written a book and that it is in the world and people actually are reading it. I do see myself still as a public radio reporter. I'm still working on some projects on the side. I have a grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism, and I've been working on a story up in Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And I think the writing and being a novelist, being a writer, is just such a dream that I don't think it's quite real. I was a reporter for over 15 years, and I think, you know, that's so embedded in me. And I still feel like radio has informed how I write as well. I feel like I write, you know, short sentences and that have a lot of, like, you know, carry a big punch. And all of that is from my training as a public radio person. And mm-hmm. I'm really grateful for that. I think it's really, really helped me in my life.
Well, it's also important in YA novels because short sentences that carry a punch are important in the structure of the book.
I think that's great. That's a good way to put it. And you know, I also feel like every word should matter. And mm-hmm. I used to be so jealous of those print reporters that we'd cover the same event. I'm like, I have, like, you know, this huge column. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, I have 4 minutes to do that same thing, you know.
Right. It's a different way.
Yeah. Right.
The Smell of Other People's Houses has been translated into several languages, and you've spent the last year traveling to some of the countries where it's been published. And it, as I mentioned, it's on the High School Battle of the Books this year, and the reviews have been very positive. John Corey Whaley, author of Where Things Come Back, said, quote, "Hitchcock's debut resonates with the timeless quality of a classic. This is a fascinating character study, a poetic interweaving of rural isolation and coming of age," end quote. Are you surprised at the reviews and the immense success you have received?
Totally flabbergasted, actually. Yes, I'm completely surprised. And can I just say that Where Things Come Back by John Corey Whaley was one of my favorite books. And when he, you know, blurbed it, it's called a blurb. It's a funny word, right?
Right.
Yeah, when he blurbed my book, it was, like, unbelievable to me. Mm-hmm. I just totally adore his writing. And, yeah,
absolutely.
I am completely surprised. I really am. And I'm really honored, and I don't take it for granted at all. I think this is an unusual turn of events.
Well, you're heading off to New Zealand tomorrow, I think?
I'm actually heading to Germany for 2 weeks. The book was nominated for the German Literature Prize at the Frankfurt Book Fair, so I'm heading over there for that.
That's a big deal.
It's an incredible honor.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks, Lori.
Do you have another book in progress?
I do. I'm writing something now, and the only thing that I actually can say about it is that it has nothing to do with Alaska.
Oh. Okay. Well, I'm sure it'll be great. If you just joined us, I'm on Beyond the Cover. I'm speaking with Bonnie Sue Hitchcock, author of The Smell of Other People's Houses. And it's been a real pleasure to speak with you today. Is there anything else you'd like to add or tell us about yourself or your writing experiences?
No, I just want to thank you. And I told you before, you know, how much I love public radio. I love KMXT. I've actually produced stories for Alaska Fisheries Report in the past, and so I love that station, and I'm very, very honored to be on your show.
Well, it's an honor for us to be able to speak with you. Thank you, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock, for joining us, and it was a pleasure, as I said, and safe travels to you.
Thank you so much.
No, you're welcome.
And you're listening to Dog-Eared Reads, Kodiak Public Library Association's show for book lovers of all ages on KODK 90.7 Kodiak, Alaska. Please consider becoming a member of the Kodiak Public Library Association. KPLA memberships and donations help to support the public library's programming and collections, to host events such as the Crabfest book sale, and more. To join, stop by the library or visit us online at kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org. Thank you for your support.
Hello and welcome to another in the series of book reviews from the resource materials of the Alaska Room of the Kodiak Public Library. Today's title is From Humboldt to Kodiak, 1886 to 1895 by Fred Roscoe, published by the Limestone Press, University of Alaska in 1992. My name is Bob Ross, and it is my pleasure to be with you today. This book is largely the first-hand accounts of Fred and his parents, Ida and Ernest Roscoe, in the late 19th century Kodiak. This family spent 6 years in the village of Kodiak from 1886 to 1891 and another 2 more years on Wood Island from 1893 to 1895. the Roscoes established the first American school at Kodiak and later surveyed and built the Baptist Mission and Orphanage on Wood Island. The Roscoes' child, Agnes Ernestine Roscoe, born the 3rd of May in 1887, is thought to be the first white child not of Russian descent to be born on Kodiak Island. The Roscoes were in Kodiak during the historic murder of Benjamin McIntyre by Peter Anderson. Ernest Roscoe was part of the searching party seeking to bring Mr. Anderson to justice. The account of this killing is the best, most detailed, that I have read until the Kodiak Mirror article published earlier in 2015. This book gives a feel for the dynamics of the pre-1900 Kodiak, its social structure, the fur trade, the Russian church influence, social cultures and practices. My stated interest in researching and reading about Kodiak is roughly the World War II time period, 1939 to 1946. Yet this book was a valuable read even for one such as I with my narrow interest. So much information is contained in this book that is helpful in understanding the Kodiak people in its early territorial development, the town layout, and the Russian cultural legacy. This book helps me to better be able to assimilate other source information into better understanding and meaning, as an example, the statement that Kodiak was a sleepy fishing village until the 1939 construction boom. This book also is a jumping-off point for seeking further information in areas noted by Roscoe in his book. A large totem grave marker of high craftsmanship in the native cemetery on Wood Island is an example. The remains and location of Russian works on Wood Island, or how Prohibition worked in practice in Kodiak, are other examples of local history which might be further investigated. Law and order is another theme, with many examples from this book. For when the Roscoes first arrived, there was no local government, no federal control except for the customs collection and for the oversight of the revenue cutters like the Bear, and murder was not an uncommon event. A Russian priest was murdered in the town of Yuzinki on Spruce Island. A man named Shu Shar Inkin was sentenced by the Kodiak Town Fathers on circumstantial evidence to 1 year confinement on an uninhabited island a short distance from St. Paul Harbor near Wood Island. It was that, or he was to be hanged. His sentence was self-directed. He could only row his skiff in for supplies and return to his Isle of Exile. If he was found in violation of his sentence, he would be immediately hanged. He served his sentence to the day, returning to Kodiak at great personal risk during a northwesterly storm, he not willing to wait even one extra day on his Isle of Confinement. He lived quietly in the Kodiak community thereafter. Did you know that Kodiak could lay claim to having the Brooklyn Bridge? Before the ash fall of 1912, there was a creek fed by at least two freshwater ponds, one in the area between Monk's Rock and the old craft store. The other pond is in the area of McDonald's on Lower Mill Bay Road. The footbridge was located near the creek's entrance to the harbor. The small suburb called Brooklyn was on the Pillar Mountain side of the stream, with the village of Kodiak on the other side. The bridge took its name from the Brooklyn suburb. Later, after the ash had filled the ponds and both drain pipes and fill closed over what remained of the stream, that Brooklyn suburb ceased to be. It was all just Kodiak then. Brooklyn Avenue got its name from this former suburb and roughly followed the course of the now defunct stream after the drains were put in place. And it remained Brooklyn Avenue until sometime after urban renewal in 1964, following the tidal wave, to be now Lower Mill Bay Road. The crook that's in the main street of Old Kodiak is due to the village development and building before the ashfall and eruption in 1912. Fred Roscoe's account of the 1890 death of U.S. Customs Collector Finnegan mentions the Brooklyn Bridge. Finnegan's lifeless body was found submerged in the Near Island Channel just off the American Commercial Company's wharf, which is now the ferry dock and visitor center. Investigations showed a trail of blood from the dock all the way to the Brooklyn Bridge, where a pool of blood was found, as though whoever was carrying the body, or Finnegan himself, had rested. That blood trail continued across the bridge into a Brooklyn native woman's house, where evidence of a terrific fight was found. Everything was topsy-turvy and blood-spattered, including the walls. Finnegan had a reputation of being a mean, ugly man and picking fights when he was drunk. He was known to have been drinking the last time he was seen alive. Very few people liked him. The coroner's jury, after several days' investigation, ruled that Finnegan had met his death by falling off the wharf and hitting his head on a spike sticking out of a piling, thus cutting off the top of his scalp and drowning him. Much, much more is remembered in the pages of this autobiographical book. I really enjoyed From Humboldt to Kodiak, 1886 to 1895 by Fred Roscoe, and believe you will too. I hope you have enjoyed this book review from a selection of the books of the Alaska Room in the Kodiak Public Library. My name is Bob Ross, and until our next book review, I bid you good reading. Thank you for tuning in today.
Do you like to read? Do you like to listen to books? I do. Hi, I'm Lori Madsen. I would like to tell you about Listen Alaska, a free service offered by the Alaska Digital Library, in part from the Kodiak Public Library. It's accessible from a computer, tablet, or a phone. You can listen directly from the browser on your computer or use an OverDrive app on a smartphone or a tablet. They have featured collections that include fiction of various genres for all ages, a wealth of nonfiction titles, and all the Battle of the Books. You can borrow up to 10 items at a time, and you can put anything on hold that'll be ready for you once it's checked back in. The lending period may vary from title to title, but the maximum is 21 days, and they can be renewed. A really cool feature of this service is when the audiobook or ebook is due, it disappears from your device. No more overdue fines or worrying about getting that item back to the library on time. To get started, you will need to have an active library card to borrow titles. Please visit the Kodiak Public Library and get your PIN, personal identification number, that will allow you to sign on to the Alaska Digital Library and start using it. What? Don't have a library card? Any permanent resident of the Kodiak Island Borough is eligible for a library card. New patrons are asked to show two pieces of identification that have their current mailing address in Kodiak on it, and parental permission is required for children under the age of 15. But once you have your PIN and your library card, you can log into OverDrive on your computer. The URL is listenalaska.lib.overdrive.com. Or do a simple search for Listen Alaska and you will find the URL. You can also download the app from iTunes or an Android source, and it's a great way to read more and keep learning. I like to listen to a story while I'm driving and then continue reading it later at a more convenient time. Or with more difficult text, I listen as I follow along in a book. Quite often, our public library has the print version, and then I borrow the audio version from the digital library. It's all free, and it's available 24/7 from Listen Alaska. Check it out. Next up, we have another segment of Beyond the Cover. This time, Kate Lowen reviews the book Madonnas of Leningrad by Deborah Dean.
This is Kate, and I am reviewing a book that maybe you haven't heard of called The Madonnas of Leningrad by Deborah Dean. It's published by Harper in 2006, and it's a short novel of historical fiction. And I came upon this book in our library here while looking for books about art and painters. And the author does render elegant descriptions of Hermitage paintings, which make you want to go to St. Petersburg, or at least tour the museum website. But the book turned out to be a little treasure in itself. Stories within stories. One of a young girl, Marina Buryakov, who worked as a docent in the Hermitage Museum at the outbreak of World War II, and how she kept her sanity by recreating the museum in her mind while coping with years of starvation, bitter cold, and relentless destruction. And I quote, "No one weeps anymore, or if they do, it's over small things, inconsequential moments that catch them unprepared. What is left that is heartbreaking? Not death. Death is ordinary. What is heartbreaking is the sight of a single gull lifting effortlessly from a street lamp. Its wings unfurl like silk scarves against mauve sky, and Marina hears the rustle of its feathers. What is heartbreaking is that there is still beauty in the world." End quote. And there's a story of Marina's love, Dmitri, her childhood friend and eventual husband, despite separation during the war. And the story of present-day Marina, now 82, struggling with the onset of Alzheimer's. As the details of her daily life slip away, the recollections of her youth become more vivid, and as her past overtakes the present, there are poignant scenes as family members try to understand. Like many war survivors, she never spoke of her experiences with her children, and they will never know her past story. From her husband's viewpoint, and I quote, "It didn't matter. The bond that first brought them together as children existed whether they spoke of it or not, the bond of survivors. Here in America, a relentlessly foolish and optimistic country, what they knew drew them closer together. She was his country and he was hers. They were inseparable, until now. She's leaving him, not all at once, which would be painful enough, but in a wrenching succession of separations. One moment she's here, and then she's gone again, and each journey takes her a little farther from his reach. He cannot follow her, and he wonders where she goes when she leaves." End quote. And there's a true story, that during the 900 days of the Leningrad siege, the staff of the Hermitage and their families, 2,000 people, lived in the basement of the museum. The staff worked frantically to remove the art pieces from the museum and ship them off for safekeeping. The frames, however, were left hanging in place, perhaps as a symbol that the paintings would return someday. One of the docents who worked there began to give tours of the museum to visitors, and it was said that he would describe them so well that the visitors could almost see them. There are other more compelling, better scripted books about the horrors of the war, or about the complexities of family relationships, but this book is so creatively constructed, and I appreciated its underlying gentleness despite the sadness. It made me consider that there may be moments of dementia that are not terrifying or upsetting. And I quote from the book, "One of the effects of this deterioration seems to be that as the scope of her attention narrows, it also focuses like a magnifying glass on smaller pleasures that have escaped her attention for years. She keeps these observations to herself. She once tried to point out to Dmitri the bottomless beauty in her glass of tea. It looked like amber with buried embers of light, and when held just so, there was a rainbow in the glass that took her breath away. He nodded sympathetically, but mostly looked concerned." End quote. Maybe we onlookers are the ones more lost and confused. Anyway, find your way to this book, Madonnas of Leningrad, by Deborah Dean.
Thank you, Kate, for that awesome review. I look forward to taking a look for that book next time I'm at the library. In our community roar, or raving over amazing reads, Jan Chatto reviews a book about surfing. Give a listen.
My name's Jan Chatto, and many of you know me. I love books. And I was doing something the other day, which many of you have done. I'm just surfing the web looking for a new book to either buy or get from my library. And I saw a book called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life by William Finnegan. And my husband was an avid surfer, so I thought, well, maybe this would be interesting. Then I noticed it won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for autobiography, which surprised me because often surf articles are more like, "Hey, dude, the wave was rad," and that's about all you get. But with this book, there was a lot more. The Pulitzer Prize board said that it was an old school adventure story and intellectual autobiography, a social history, a literary road movie, and an extraordinary exploration of the gradual mastering of an exacting, little understood art, which I thought said a lot. So it's the story of Bill Finnegan's life, but it's also a study in why we can become obsessed with something in our lives, which in this case was surfing. I could relate to this tale because my own husband had been bitten by the surfing bug when he was a young boy also. I was witness to his endless fascination with surfing and wanted to understand it a bit more. However, this book is far more than just a book about surfing. Finnegan is a brilliant writer and reporter who has written for The New Yorker and Outside magazines. I particularly enjoyed the characters he so vividly recalls. Let's face it, extreme sports attract eccentric people, and he brings them to life. Fishermen can probably relate to Finnegan's endless fascination with the ocean and the weather. However, the details of the sport do not drag the reader into a rabbit warren of details. They seem essential to the tale. They remind me of the technical details found in Daniel Brown's Boys in the Boat, the true story of a rowing team. I enjoyed that book also, even though there were a lot of details about rowing and building boats. This memoir is a coming-of-age memoir to begin with. He was a Haole boy suddenly transplanted to Hawaii. And for any of you who don't know, Haole means little white kid. So he was definitely the outsider. He says, "Matters weren't helped by the fact that to my classmates, I seemed not to exist socially." I'm sure some of us can relate to that. I was the new kid in a high school myself. "For my husband, it was a disfiguring accident that sent him into social limbo. The surfing crowd didn't care what his face looked like. The love of the sport and the ocean was their bond. This book dives deeply into the inner motivation for our passions." Finnegan says, "Memoir is a weird genre for a reporter. You end up investigating your own private life to be super self-centered, which is the opposite of reporting. He kept journals in his youth, which were helpful, although he says they were not so much full of facts as they were obtuse and abstract. The impetus to begin the book, which had been floating around in his head for years, came from letters that he had written to a friend some 40 years ago, which were returned to him by that friend's mother. I wonder if any of us will have words of our youth preserved like that." In an interview, he states, "I try to ease people into the water, keep them oriented, introduce the terms of the art without dumbing things down. Give readers a stake in every surf scene, not necessarily through action, but through characters. Core surfers rightly snort at every crossover effort to depict their world. Credibility and authenticity just seem to vanish. We can all recall the Gidget movies. This book brings that world vividly to life. I traveled all over the world with Finnegan and his weird buddies as he sought the perfect wave." One of the conflicts of the book is, how do you continue a passion like this and still be the grown-up with a family and the big boy job? Should you continue your passion, or should you just let it go? And that conflict plays through the book as he tries to decide and then jumps for that next wave. I found the book fascinating and a really good read. So I would recommend it to anybody, even if you're not a particular surfing fan. The name of the book again is Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life by William Finnegan.
Thank you, Jan. And a big thanks to everyone who has contributed to this radio show and provided us with interesting ideas for new books to read.
Up next on Dog-Eared Reads today, a good friend of mine, Lexa Meyer, is joining me in the studio. She is one of the friends that I go to when I have gardening questions. She has a lot of knowledge and some book reviews she'd like to share with us. I'm actually really excited because other than giving you some good books about gardening, Lexa has also brought in some good fiction books that feature gardening in their plot. And I thought that would be a good thing to do, not just to focus on all technical textbooks, but also to focus on some of the more fun summer reads you garden-loving people out there might want to enjoy. So I'm going to turn it over now to Lexa to share with you what she brought.
Great. Well, thank you, Thea, for inviting me. I have two fiction books and two nonfiction books to talk about today. I'll start with nonfiction. These are two of my favorites. They're not technical manuals on gardening per se, but they both have a lot of really interesting information about the history of gardening, the importance of heirlooms. We hear a lot about things like heirlooms and hybrids and GMOs and all this stuff these days. And really, these two books stress the importance of plants as they were when we first discovered them and raised them for agricultural use, and then how we've modified them to suit our purposes and sometimes not for the better. The first book I'd like to talk about is just a really fun read. It's very inspirational. It's about a couple, Jer and Emily Gessel, as I think how you say their name. And they started Baker Creek Seeds, and a lot of garden people are familiar with them. They're based out of Missouri and now have seed stores on the East Coast, West Coast, and then they're in the center of the United States. They're just fabulous. They specialize. They're total plant nerds. And they met online and started this empire of beautiful heirlooms from all over the world. They were currently just in Japan. I follow them on their Instagram account. And they wrote this lovely book featuring some of their favorite heirloom varieties, the history of Baker Creek Seeds, the company they started. They give some gardening advice and tips and growing things in the book. But it's really just a fabulous read with gorgeous pictures. I mean, I like to call it plant porn. I mean, the photos are beautiful if you enjoy gorgeous heirloom vegetables. And that is available at the Kodiak Public Library. And
what's it called?
It's called the Heirloom Life Gardener. And it's just a beautiful book. Heirloom Life Gardener by Jer and Emily Kessel, and it's just beautiful.
And so they actually founded this company where you get a lot of your seeds from.
They did. They did. Yeah. Jer actually started it when he was like 17 years old and did it out of his bedroom because he had favorite plant varieties he'd grown growing up in Missouri and in Colorado as a kid. And then he decided to start his own seed company. And it just took off from there because he was featuring heirloom varieties that people hadn't been able to find for decades. Of course, he got online and then the word kind of spread on the online community and his seed sales just exploded.
Can you very briefly, for people that might not be very into gardening and might not know what an heirloom is, can you describe that?
Sure, yeah. So I'll talk a little bit about that. Heirlooms are... And now they've kind of changed the definition of an heirloom. It's not something that has to be 100 or 200 years old. It's just a variety now that can be propagated from seed. So a lot of plants, garden varieties, are actually hybrids where they're crossed by two plants, and it's what we call the F1 or the first generation of that cross of those two plants makes a really vigorous, happy plant. But unfortunately, because it's a cross, if you were to pollinate even two of the same individuals of those hybrids, you wouldn't necessarily get a offspring of those plants that would hold true to its characteristics because it will pull out parent genes from the two parents and may kind of give irregular results. Heirlooms are ones you can take the seeds and they'll grow the same plant year after year after year. And that's kind of what the definition of an heirloom's been changed to. So it's not necessarily something that your great-great-grandma had to grow. There's people that are actually generating new heirlooms as we speak. And tomatoes are one of those fastly evolving heirloom varieties.
Typically, if you're buying your seeds from many of the places around town, those seeds, while they might give you a plant that has seeds, you wouldn't be able to replant those seeds growing from your plant and find it successful.
Yeah, you might get success, but it wouldn't hold true to the parent type. Things like summer squash, especially, a lot of the most popular varieties grown in the United States are actually F1 cross hybrids. And so you couldn't save seeds from those zucchinis, say, and expect to get the same results next year.
But if you get your seeds from...
If you get heirloom seeds, you can then save your seeds and you could have plants for generations to come. And sometimes you might have to breed a little bit of vigor back in by bringing in some new genetics. But you could save those for years, which is really cool.
Okay. What's your other book, Lexa?
My other nonfiction book is The Botany of Desire by Michael Pollan. And a lot of people have read that book. His writings are very popular. But again, that book remains one of my favorite plant books because it talks about the human interrelationships and how plants have changed human society. And sometimes for good and sometimes for not so good. He talks about three different plants. He talks about apples. He talks about tulips. He talks about cannabis, and he talks about potatoes and how the growing of those said things has shaped commerce, how they've shaped, you know, how what we come to perceive as now an apple is something very different, of course, from the original apple or crab apples or wild apples, and how there used to be, you know, thousands and thousands of varieties of, say, apples, and now there's only like a handful that you can find in the supermarket, and it's the pursuit of sweetness and this kind of really... It's something completely different than what an apple really actually is or was. I like the talk about tulips. Tulips became a commodity in Europe because they were so highly valued, and they were worth more than gold at a certain point in certain areas of Europe, which is just insane. And it was all just because they were beautiful. Of course, they have no food value, but it was just for the sake of the beauty of the tulip. And then cannabis, of course, we all know why cannabis is important, because of course. It gets as high, but the other thing it does too is that we're now finding is that there are probably some medical applications for that plant. And it started out as a plant that was grown mostly for fiber, and then people realized you could get high off of it. And then we've completely changed that plant from its ancestor, hemp, now to a plant that's, I mean, how many varieties must there be now of that particular plant? So that's one we've definitely taken and changed to suit our needs. And then finally, the potato. And everyone is, of course, familiar with potatoes. We eat potatoes all the time. There used to be thousands of varieties of potatoes growing, and now there's just a handful of potatoes that are grown commercially. I mean, you get russets, Yukon Golds, and red new potatoes at the store, and that's about it. You know, we're starting to see things like purple potatoes, and those things show up on grocery store shelves. But he talks heavily about the Irish potato famine and how that was a result of growing only one variety of potato. Whereas if they had been growing multiple varieties, they may have averted that disaster because some of them may have been immune to the potato blight. But because they put so much trust in one crop and one specific variety of that crop, that's what caused almost 1 million people to die. And it was very, very sad.
So this is less a book about gardening techniques and more really just a study of
a sociological
impact of what humans have done to agriculture.
Exactly. So it gives a kind of a different spin from a nonfiction perspective on gardening, which I thoroughly appreciate.
And this author, what's his name again?
Michael Pollan.
Right.
He's written other books, The Omnivore's Dilemma, where he talks about food and relationship to food. Yeah, there's some really, really good books that he's written.
Yeah, I thought that it might be important to mention that. So if you read The Omnivore's Dilemma and you like that author, this is another one of his great books to read.
All right. And then I have two fiction books, and these are really, really fun books. One's a little more serious than the other. The first one is by an author. Her name is Barbara Kingsolver, and she's a fabulous author. She's written many, many books. Her book, Prodigal Summer, is my favorite by far. I love that book. She kind of chronicles a year in the life of these people in this small town in the Ozarks. And it's just a beautiful story. And it shows just how wonderfully tied these people's lives are to the earth. And some of the characters are just studying the natural environment, and others are actively participating in it. They're farming, they're growing things. It's just a beautiful, beautiful book. And she therein talks about the importance of heirloom varieties and how in America alone there used to be, you know, back in the 1920s, like hundreds and thousands of different varieties of all these different plants that were grown worldwide in the United States. And then that number was compressed greatly with kind of this big agricultural revolution that happened post-World War. And now there's just a handful of varieties of things we see in the grocery store. And that's really a shame because there were so many that were wonderful. And a lot of those are lost now. They're now functionally extinct. They're just gone. She talks about that. And it's just a beautiful book. She really gives a nice sense of place. It can be a little heavy at times. You know, there's a big poignant message. But it's a very good read. I don't want to spoil too much about it.
And say again the title for me?
Prodigal Summer.
Prodigal Summer by Barbara Kingsolver.
Barbara Kingsolver, yes.
Mm-hmm. And your last book is a lot more lighthearted, isn't it?
Oh, it's super fun. It's just a beautiful read. And all the characters are involved in gardening or agriculture in some way. They're just adorable. It's by an author. Her name is Bailey White, and you may recognize her. She's been on NPR. And she's just a fabulous writer. And her book, this is the book I just love, is called Quite a Year for Plums. And it's a funny title. There's really no plot. It just chronicles the kind of everyday goings-on and funny anecdotes from a group of people living in a little small town in southern Georgia. And it's super cute. Love that book. The characters are wonderful. The two main characters, they're actually older women, which I super appreciate. You know, they're often... You know, women, as we age, we're not well represented in literature. And if we are, we're kind of marginalized. And they're really kind of the main characters, which I appreciate a great deal. Yeah, and it's just really fun. It talks about, you know, people that live there in their entire lives, how people that come to visit interact with those people. And it's just really a fun read.
So is this written from the point of view of one of the old ladies? Is it a third person?
No, it's not a third person. It's first person, and you're just talking to the different people and popping in little different scenarios in everyone's lives. It's very cute. I mean, for everything from a day spent trimming a plum tree to a day spent out in the woods, the two main characters, they bring their rocking chairs out into the forest. And they like to sit and just rock in their rocking chairs and enjoy a quiet evening in the South. And it's really cute.
So it's not a plot-driven specific story.
Nope.
With like a climate. It's a series of anecdotes about this small town.
Exactly.
With these characters.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fun. Sounds pretty lighthearted and good for people that love gardening to have a light summer read.
Definitely, yeah. And the ladies grow a beautiful garden. They talk about making vidala onion pies and all sorts of things with what they grow in their garden. It's just wonderful. I like it quite a bit.
And I would like to mention, I think you told me the other night, I want to share this with everybody, that you actually read this book every summer. Do you want to talk to us about that?
Oh, yeah. It was actually a book I found at the Setnet site, and I just let it live down there, and I love it so much I read it every year because it's like coming back home and getting to know the characters again. It's just something fun, you know, when you have one of those rainy afternoons in the cabin. And it's a book, it's a very short read. You can read it in a day if you want to. And you can just curl up with a good book and a cup of hot chocolate and watch the rain fall.
I really like that story, the idea of going out to the Setnet site and having a look on the cabin bookshelf walls and finding this book that you end up enjoying so much that it becomes a yearly ritual to read it again. That's fantastic. I have a lot of books out at our SciNet site, but I haven't found one yet that's worth rereading every summer. So I'll definitely have to pick up.
Quite a year for plums.
Quite a year for plums. Yes. That's right. Okay.
My husband loves the title. He likes to make fun of it, but darling book.
Great. Thanks, Lexa. And I guess before you go, I would say, do you have a tip that you'd like to share, or maybe important piece of advice you'd like to give to all of us out there that may not be very good gardeners, that maybe something simple that we can all take home to our gardens to use to improve it over the summer?
Yes, and I just had something happen today. It's good. It's my best bit of advice to someone getting started gardening is don't give up. I had a major setback in my gardening world. Some of my starts have kicked the bucket for no reason. I'm going to get to the bottom of it, but I have to restart a bunch of things. So start early and don't give up. Because even if you've done this, you know, this will be my, 11th year gardening in Alaska. Don't give up. Sometimes you have little setbacks, but that's all they are. Plants are amazing. They'll catch up fast.
Oh, that is good advice. Yeah, not to get discouraged as you're learning. If there's what seems to be failures, it's just opportunity for learning and growth.
Exactly.
Great. Well, thank you, Lexa, for coming in.
You're welcome. It was great coming in. Thanks.
It was fun. Definitely sharing all those books has been a great opportunity to find some good reads for myself over the summer. So I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Athenia Large interviewing Lexa Meyer on gardening. And thanks to Athenia, this show got off the ground 2 years ago and has had a successful run. Without her energy, it may never have gotten started. So I hope you enjoyed rehearing that interview.
And welcome again to the Poetry Corner on Dog-Eared Reads. This is When I Heard the Learned Astronomer by Walt Whitman. When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures, were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I sitting heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon unaccountable I became, tired and sick, till rising and gliding out I wandered off by myself in the mystical moist night air and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. And today we have The Housekeeper by Charles Lamb. The frugal snail with forecast of repose carries his house with him wherever he goes, peeps out, and if there comes a shower of rain, retreats to his small domicile again. Touch but a tip of him, a horn, it is well, he curls up in his sanctuary shell. He's his own landlord, his own tenant. Stay, long as he will, he dreads no quarter day. Himself he boards and lodges, both invites and feasts himself. Sleeps with himself, o nights, he spares the upholster trouble to procure chattels. Himself is his own furniture and his sole riches. Wheresoever he roams, knock when you will, he's sure to be at home.
Thank you, Tayton. That was great. And thank you so much for producing the Poetry Corner for Dog-Eared Reads. Don't forget Kodiak Public Library Association's coming up on its annual meeting March 17th at Monk's Rock at 9:30 a.m., all members are welcome to come to this free breakfast. What? You're not a member? Well, you can become one that day at the meeting, or you can sign up online. Our website is kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org. Our mission is to support the library, its programming, and the events that go on there. We hope you've enjoyed Dog-Eared Reads, and happy reading, everybody.
Walk across the courtyard towards the library.